Greetings and welcome to another edition of Orientation Ryan Station, the Lost Podcast. My name is Ryan McGee. I run the Lost blog over at Zap2It. With me, as always, my partner in crime, the other Ryan of the equation, Mo Ryan from the Chicago Tribune. How you doing, Mo?
I'm doing great, thanks.
And we have a special guest today from Time Magazine. We have James Poniewozik. James, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, or James, is it James Ryan Poniewozik?
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
It's like Ramones.
Exactly. For today, your name is James Ryan Poniewozik.
That's fantastic. We are glad to have you here on the podcast. As returning listeners know, what we do is we watch the episode from our respective homes across the country. You can follow along either on your DVR or on Hulu, but you don't have to do that. The topics themselves range everywhere from the Lost universe and aren't specific necessarily to this episode. So if you want to download it to your iPod via iTunes, you are more than welcome to do that, and you'll get a great experience as well. And I'm happy to have you guys on here for what I thought was easily one of the best, if not the best, episode of the season, Dr. Linus.
Yeah, I agree, and I think definitely for me, my favorite Flash sideways, Flash alternate, Flash whatever we're going to end up calling it after the whole season is done.
Absolutely, Mo. What about you? What are your pre-thoughts?
Yeah, I thought it was really, really well done. Absolutely. In terms of Flash sideways, I think, you know, in the season premiere, that was such a novelty that I was kind of like, well, that's kind of cool or that's interesting, and then it got not as cool and not as interesting, but definitely this episode tied that sideways flashiness into the arc of the episode incredibly well. So it was, you know, whatever misgivings I might have about that as a plot device, I think, you know, this episode as a whole absolutely worked for me.
Absolutely. So after the musical break, we're going to start in with the opening scenes of Lost, and we'll do musical breaks in between each act so you can kind of catch up, sync up if you're following along from home. And we'll get started right after this. Previously on Lost, Ben got all stabby.
And that did not go well for Jacob.
Or did it? That's the question. At a certain point, you have to realize that Jacob might have been the greatest strategist in the history of strategizing, given how many things had to happen for him to pull his plan off.
Well, that is something you have to start thinking about when people talk about Jacob having a plan. It's funny, this is not directly related to this episode, but, you know, I was going back earlier today rereading another Lost watch that I'd done for another reason, and I recall that, you know, Richard figures in this episode. And it was Richard who told John Locke that he had to go back and die originally, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, if he's getting that from Richard, who's getting a plan from Jacob, what does that mean? You know,
right.
Did Jacob ultimately want Locke to die? Did he ultimately know how and why Locke would die and who would assume his... I mean...
Yeah.
What is Jacob doing in my life? Where do his principles end?
Although,
I'm pretty sure, I think by the end of the season, we realized that it was actually the Man in Black, as Locke, telling Richard to tell himself to do it. I mean, yeah, exactly. At some point, you realize, okay, you know what? This is TV, and this is how excellent writing versus excellent planning might get pulled off here. But in the episode itself, we've got Ben running into Elena and company. And
if I could just be nitpicker supreme, where did they get the torches? Did they sort of swipe them from the temple and think to bring them along?
They got them.
My husband was like, so definitely bring torches when there are people around who want to kill you.
They stopped by the Isle of Elba, clearly.
A supply of torches.
Of course. Yeah, perfect size and shape, obviously. Yeah.
I also love the property of this island that no matter where you walk from one point to another, it's always, if it's night when you start, it's going to be day when you get to the other side.
That's a really good point.
I don't know if you're like walking like 50 feet. It's dawn will have broken by the time you get to where you're going.
Thanks, pretty much. And now we have the show that Alan Sepinwall very much hopes gets spun off into its own series, which is Ben Linus, Teacher of European History.
By day.
Very professorial in his sweater and glasses and, you know, dealing with a not particularly warm and cuddly boss.
No, that's true. I mean, this guy, he specializes in playing this type of role. I mean, for me, I just saw him as Walter Peck, and I will always see him as Walter Peck from Ghostbusters.
Right.
There's no other way to sort of, you know, get around it. So he's going there, and we've got Ben here in his, you know, it's amazing what a sweater can do for a character.
Exactly.
A sweater and a posture.
But I love, you know, when you watch what Michael Emerson does in this episode, one thing that really impressed me is that he simultaneously makes this version of Ben a very different guy, and yet the same guy.
Exactly.
You know, not just the same mannerisms, but the same sort of, you know, although he's, this Ben is idealistic and he's interested in the good of the kids and so on, you know, he also has that sort of same, you know, just fussiness and sense of, you know, injured rectitude.
Right.
That, you know, which I think is important because it seems that this Flash Sideways, as you wrote about today, Maureen, is sort of talking about how, you know, things have happened to him and he's made choices and he could have gone one way or another.
Yeah, I think that's really this whole episode, you know, as I wrote, this could have been him reading the phone book and I would have been interested because Michael Emerson is just that compelling of an actor.
Yep.
But they really gave him a lot to play here. And I think you're absolutely right that there's always that edge of resentment to Ben. There's always that sense that someone's done him wrong or he hasn't gotten what he should have gotten. And here we have Locke, as he will do in the other timeline, the island timeline, kind of nudging him along and saying, you know, take what's yours. Why are you putting up with these people trying to do this or that to you? You know, you should take control of the situation and do what you want. And that's really the crux of the dilemma here. Should he just do what's best for him or, you know, I don't know if we wanted to call it the right thing, but somehow a more admirable thing. And I think he kind of did in both timelines. I was really intrigued by something that various people wrote about today. I think you did too, James, which was this idea that, as I was calling it, you know, the let's make a deal timeline. Like, let's pretend that these alternate timelines are what they asked for. And the interesting wrinkle to me is this idea that people have been talking about that hadn't really occurred to me is what you ask Jacob for versus what you ask Man in Black for, and how those, you know, seeing how the two teams, as it were, are aligned, you know, maybe that's one way to look at these Flash Sideways. Do you guys kind of think that makes them more interesting, or are they still the same level of opaque for you?
Well, opaque and interesting aren't necessarily mutually exclusive for me. As long as the two timelines have meaning in relation to each other, I'm willing to sort of wait it out, and I'm hoping by the end of the sort of second third of the season that we have at least a sense of what they mean or what the stakes are in this universe. I mean, getting back to that scene with Locke in the cafeteria, it's almost as if the Man in Black was subtly sneaking in there in a way that we haven't seen before in the timeline. And the idea that what can happen in one bleeds into the other and then that it's a two-way street is something I've found intriguing ever since Jack looked at himself in the mirror in Oceanic 815 and saw that little cut upon his neck. But the idea, James, you talked about before about Ben's the same but different. The idea that these people are born with the same basic stuff, the same basic composition that gets sort of whittled down and honed over the course of a lifetime. It's just that depending on your lifetime, certain things get either brought to the front or subsumed or deleted entirely is quite fascinating. What we see in this Flash Sideways is almost as if the island Ben pops into Sideways Ben more and more and more to the point where we think he's going to cross over, which is where all the tension, at least for me, came in. To the point where in that last scene, I may or may not have actually shouted at Ben because I thought he had betrayed his daughter once again. I'm not saying that I did. There's no record of that as far as you know, but
you stand up?
I might have stood up. It's possible. I'll have to ask my wife when she comes back downstairs, but hopefully she won't sell me out.
That was the tension of the episode. That's a really good point. That was the tension of the episode, and is Ben Ben? Is he going to be the Ben we saw on the island? Is that an intrinsic quality to him that he cannot resist manipulating events in his own favor?
Absolutely.
No matter what the cost to other people.
And I think we're at the act break now. When we get back, I do want to return to this point about what does it mean to ask Jacob for something? What does it mean to ask the Man in Black for something? Because that's really at the crux of what this episode is, which I hope gets to some illumination about what the sideways flashes are. But we'll talk about that after the break. All right, we're back to the beach, but not in a sort of 50s Annette Funicello sort of way. What do you guys think about this sort of return? We'll see more in this episode about, you know, landmarks from seasons past. We've seen the caves. Now we're back at the beach. Soon we'll see the Black Rock. Is this nostalgia for nostalgia's sake, or is it working for you guys?
Well, you know, it's just kind of interesting in a, you know, wrapping things up kind of way, because you remember how Lost was, you know, originally conceived as, you know, let's just do a fiction version of Survivor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, elements of this last season have reminded me of the section of the Survivor finale where you revisit the past challenges,
right.
You know, and the fallen immunity idols and whatever of your old, you know, so there is kind of you know, Lost greatest hits elements to this, you know, which Curly referenced when you know, talked to Jack about walking across the island, old school.
Oh, good times, good times.
You know, that I kind of like it. And in the sense that, you know, they're going back to the beach and trying to keep Smokey from killing them, you're also kind of returning to the roots of season one, where it was very much just a show about raw survival.
Right. And it's funny because my husband brought up last night, he goes, oh, it looks like they're really kind of dividing into these two factions. And I'm like, honey, I love you, but that's been the entire plot of the show for six seasons now. It's like, that's the whole like, well, now we're this faction, and now we're that faction. And then suddenly a certain faction would just kind of go away. You know, it's just the moving into place of different teams would take half a season, and then you'd be like, oh, and then guess what? It didn't actually matter after four more episodes, you know?
Right. It's obviously a ploy to get all the Twilight fans in.
You know. The Team Jacob thing, yeah.
This is the only Team Jacob thing. But now on screen, we've got Ben and his father, who I expected to see maybe Annie at home or someone else that he would be married to. It never occurred to me that his father would be there, and that was a very nice surprise to sort of see him there.
There were some beautiful ironies in this episode, by the way, and nice callbacks, and you know, the Miles's reference to Nikki and Paula, which we'll come across later, but probably top among those have to be Ben giving his father gas.
Yep.
Yeah, a very different kind.
But in a much nicer way.
And you know, I found this actually incredibly moving. There was some great work throughout by Michael Emerson, and he always just pulls off these incredible moments. But this is just a quiet scene where you really do get the sense of this is what could have been. This is how it could have been. They could have been these kind of cantankerous guys who live together, and they're both a little bit fussy and, you know, rigid, but they have each other. And, you know, to me that's so poignant. Because, oh, someone's calling for me.
Hey. It's live. It's all good.
Sorry about that. yeah, it just seemed like kind of sad to see this in a way. Like, you wanted him to be able to have this kind of life and see his daughter again alive. You know, this. I do wonder if this is what he asked for in his "Let's Make a Deal."
It's possible.
And, you know, and it's funny too, looking at these flash sideways, that the sort of happier alternatives for most of the characters are not ecstatically happy. I mean, Hurley is wealthy and believes that he's the luckiest guy in the world and so forth. But when you look at, you know, say John Logs, he's still in a wheelchair.
Right.
You know, he's still, things have turned out better for him, but his life hasn't been miraculously transformed. What happens, is that he's more at peace with it and accepting of it and, you know, internally happier. And, you know, and likewise here, Ben has this sort of, you know, sad sack life, but he has, you know, chosen to live it with a certain amount of integrity, and that's, right, that's made all the difference.
I think Ryan made a really interesting point, and we were emailing earlier today, in that in this timeline, the parents are not the nightmare ogres of yore. You know, they're not.
Nope.
We had Locke, who was, you know, getting ready to invite his father to his wedding, or had invited his father to the wedding with Helen. you know, we've got Roger and Ben Linus living together in harmony. You know, it just seems to me like that's an interesting theme, and I wonder if, you know, that's going to be kind of a conscious thing they're going to do throughout. But, you know, I've many times made fun of Lost as the island of bad dads, and that's an interesting idea that this is a different, it's like almost like the flip side, if you will, the opposite world.
Yeah, and the bad dad thing is, it's obvious, it's there, it's sort of easy to mock, and it's not, it sometimes borders on the lazy, especially if you get the seventh Jack flashback in which he's got daddy issues. But it does tie into the notion of this sort of, you know, multi-generational, multi-millennial, if you will, war of the island. The idea of Jacob's notion of progress versus the Man in Black's notion of human stasis, that you can never evolve. Things will always be that the way they were. And a lot of it comes down from, you know, the bad traits that you are that you inherit from the generation before. You know, whether it be passed down in a negative way, or nothing positive is passed down. So you've got, you know, Anthony Cooper with Locke having a good relationship. You have Jack reaching some sort of understanding about his father through the newly created son in the Sideways timeline. And in Ben, you know, he finally gets to sort of choose a person over power in his, and that gets passed down. These are interesting things in and of themselves. You look at the timeline as an epilogue. They're more interesting if they are lessons that can be transferred back into the island in this timeline that we're watching right now.
Exactly.
Not to, you know, jinx the final season of Lost, but, you know, when you say that's, you know, that's the last 2 minutes of the Battlestar Galactica finale. And seriously, it's you know, the theme ends up being, you know, can you or can you not break a pattern? You know, has this all happened before and it will always happen again the same way over and over again? Or in fact, you know, can you change and break this pattern as you know, as Jacob was saying to the Man in Black?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one thing that this episode sort of made a little clearer to me about the Flash Sideways. You know, I still don't know how they fit into the whole picture, how real they are, and therefore how much I should be invested in it. Mm-hmm. But thematically, what it seems to me that the Flash Sideways are doing is we've seen these characters in flashbacks and then flash forwards through the course of the series kind of fall into the same patterns and make the same mistakes over and over and over again. And it seems that one thing that you're seeing in this reality or this alternate reality is characters finally breaking out of those destructive patterns.
Right.
Finally, you know, making a you know, a different choice or the right choice.
And the episode really does get into sort of what does it mean to be able to make a choice. And I think, Mo, you talked about this a lot today, that this episode reaffirmed your faith in the existence of free will and the superiority of free will in the Lost universe.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you, you know, James has written about this really eloquently, the whole idea that if, you know, that promo that we saw from Spain of like, oh, Lost is a giant chessboard, that looked really cool, but I don't want the show to be that, you know, I think that's just much less interesting, and I want these people to have a choice, and I think in a way that's why I really thought that the episode, as I said, was almost kind of a game changer, because Ben has an incredibly crucial choice to make in both timelines, a choice that basically defines who you are as a human being, who he is as a human being. And is he a human being, or is he just kind of this relentless shark driven forward by a need to survive? And it just, you know, to me, it just was really, what was so poignant about this is that Ben has always just wanted to belong somewhere. And he's taken that power, that belonging, or that position by force for the most part, because no one ever offered it freely. He never felt truly wanted, even by his own dad, in the island timeline, certainly. But, you know, in this other timeline, we see Roger kind of get it together and at least get his kid off the island somehow, and they've reached a kind of peace with each other. And, you know, Ben has that opportunity to be at peace with himself, and I want him to have chosen that, not to have made the world give him that.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And we'll explore Ben's sort of evolution towards that decision after this break. And we're back. back looking at a familiar ship. Or at least it's supposed to hearken to another ship that we might see later in this episode.
Now, it's whenever anybody tells me in the future how stupid television is when I tell them what I do for a living, I'm going to remember every time I've written up a post after an episode of Lost, and I just have windows open on my computer of, entries on the British East India Trading Company and Russian philosophers or whatnot trying to figure out just the density.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In here.
It's
a little research project every time I write about one of these. I'm sure it's like that for you guys, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, we are the passive TV generation, right? We just sort of let it wash over us. That almost makes me laugh, the idea that people are passive, because, people aren't passive at all, and these shows are so sort of fully interactive in that sense. What I kind of loved at one point, I think, is it a little bit later, or have we already blown past that part where Ben finds not only the skin mag, but the Hypotox, the Chosen.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah,
find the big booty mag already.
Which I thought it was like that kind of that's really lost in a butt shell.
Lost in a butt shell.
That's going to be the title of this podcast, Mo.
Podcast, James. So, just to me, that was such a fun dichotomy because it was like Lost is sometimes about the density of references and the literary themes and these huge, enormous ideas, and sometimes it's just about Saeed, beating up some guy, which is equally fun, in my opinion.
Or Hurley looking at his hand and wondering if it's going to disappear in him because he's seen Back to the Future 1,000 times.
Right.
They are very good, and sometimes it gets a little bit too meta, and I know that we're going to get Nikki and Paulo later. I mean, Exposé, I pushed up to the point, and maybe in some cases triple jumped over the line of where meta becomes too sort of cutesy. But the show is pretty good at, getting up to the point where it can be the most, arrogant thing in the world to talk about to these big themes, but they're good at sort of puncturing their own balloon on occasion, at least sort of bringing it back so they're not completely seen as only pretentious about the themes that they're dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, the show just has a great sense of play, which I think, it ultimately to be a really great TV show, generally you need in one way or another. It's not just all about there's this big mystery and we've plotted it out and whatever, it's that you get a real sense of fun from it.
Right.
And I think that without kind of taking shots like Exposé, you wouldn't have that. So I actually have a little fondness in my heart for Exposé just because, there's just part of me, I think it was just awesome that they did that.
Absolutely. Every show that I love, I think except maybe The Shield, has an episode that I absolutely hate. And even The Shield had the infamous Armenian money train, which after the 17th permutation of what that was about, I didn't, just completely gave up. But, Lost pokes fun at itself, and that's part of the interactivity of it, is that it's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure in a way that you can get as intense about the tiny references. I always watch every episode twice. I don't know about you guys, but that's why I'm usually up till 3 in the morning on Tuesdays. It's because I always see things and notice things, and, I'm always looking on the Lost Easter egg site the next morning to look for, little references. And, that's kind of the fun of it, is that there's a lot that is purely meant for the obsessives. There's some stuff that's purely meant to just be fun, and there's the bigger picture stuff too. So when it all comes together in an episode like this, I think it's absolutely something, a unique combination that that's the combination I'm going to miss when Lost is off the air.
No, I'm with you. And what you need in something like an episode, I think Todd Vandeworth compared this to the best episode since The Constant in his
really?
Estimation. And I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but what the two episodes do have in common is that you've got time travel, you've got different universes, but the through line is incredibly intuitive and emotional, which
absolutely.
Is sort of the
I
connections.
Think that's a great point.
And then that's if that when the show lands that, that's what's really good about when Lost transcends its sort of genre status and becomes just a good drama, not a good sort of sci-fi drama. And that's the things you can lock in. And then we've got someone, we've got Richard here approaching his old ship, which was a nice sort of, piece of information that was kind of hinted at in Follow the Leader when he was looking at the ship in the glass bottle and was semi-alluded to in LAX when Smock talks about it's weird to see you without chains. Although lost being lost, people couldn't accept that that was a literal set of chains.
Of course.
And then the Prometheus link started flying on my blog and metaphorical chains and whatnot. But sometimes a set of chains is a set of chains.
As hard as... I've got to point out a couple little things here. First of all, I love that Nestor Carbonell, he's really a subtle actor, and I think, you know, Alpert's such an interesting figure in the island's mythology that he could just kind of reside in that weird space and not really do a lot with the character. But here we've got an Alpert who's kind of pissed, you know, who's like not really pleased with his job situation, which he's just found out has been a big sham in his opinion. But there's a little bit of Turbine Tim time coming up because, you know, I just love saying that, first of all. And then second of all, this ship has been in a tropical jungle or an island, you know, setting for however many hundreds of years. And the wood is all still looking pretty good, you know. The stuff inside the ship is all okay. And there's a few vines here and there, but it's generally speaking... it's in good shape, but I just, like, what? I don't get it.
Shipwrights of Britain built a quality product.
I'm telling you.
The East India Trading Company knew what they were doing.
They should still be running the world, you know, I guess.
Maybe now they're just called the Hanzo Foundation.
So, oh!
There you go. We'll talk more about that excellently maintained ship in more matters after the break. Now, some people can never get enough arsed. I think, James, you're in that category. For me, it's probably what toned it down a bit from being a truly great episode. I mean, it was truly great, but from being, like, sort of iconic, I think his presence, his over-presence, sort of took it down a notch for me.
Pushes it into comedy, you're saying?
Or... I'm not even, just annoyance. I'm fine with comedy. I could watch Hurley and Miles talk for 45 minutes and probably think that was the best episode in the history of the world. It's a personal preference thing. Some people just love the arst. They love the Frogert. I'm not in that camp. I don't think there's anything really wrong with that. It's, you know, we're discussing art. It's not mathematics. It's not science.
Actually, I will make the argument for arts here.
Okay.
Say that really fast three times first, though.
In a nutshell, what's your defense of arst?
In a nutshell, I would say I think there was an element the first time, you know, we saw him back, earlier in season six to, oh, it's cool, isn't it great that they brought Arts back? But I think it's kind of illustrative of the bench strength that Lost has here, that he actually, I think, serves kind of an important role in Ben's Flash Sideways story here. In that Arts is the sort of, you know, cynic who's given up and he's just looking out for himself and, you know, he's kind of a dick. Is only concerned about his parking space. And you know, if you recall, all of this actually had been, you know, in very broad strokes established about him in his earlier appearance on the island. You know, you knew that he was a teacher and he was not much of a people person and he seemed to sort of have, you know, this kind of general... contempt for others. So, you know, to me, this is not just, you know, about it being cool that he reappeared, but you know, kind of the fortuitousness that Lost, with all these great characters it's created, actually had the right foil for him already ready, teaching in a school in this situation. And that is my defense of Leslie Arts.
It's a very good one.
Well done, sir.
And now we've got sort of another meta example of faith in the storytelling, in the purpose of the show. Richard Alpert as a stand-in for maybe the suffering Lost fan wondering if the payoff is actually going to be worth it.
He told me he had a plan. I mean, if that's not the most meta statement that anyone has made this season, I don't know what is. I mean, basically, this is Richard Alpert as kind of ticked off Lost fan in this scene, it seems to me. It's, you know, he's basically saying, I had faith, I followed directions, I did what was asked of me, and then I kind of didn't really get anything out of that, you know, and people were just making stuff up, and it was just a big lie. I think I don't. What is this? What are the creators saying here by having Richard Alpert voice those concerns that we as fans at some point might want to blow ourselves up?
It's unclaim. I mean, Locke tried to hang himself after realizing he had no purpose. And if you talk about the sort of time in which he was experienced his time on the island to the point where he tried to hang himself, that wasn't that long. Richard's been around for a couple hundred years. So you multiply Locke's angst times a million, and you've got Richard Alpert here. But it's good. I mean, yeah, season two Locke and season six Alpert have a lot in common in terms of the destruction of their faith. But to see the man who's been sort of the stoic, you know, all-powerful, sort of shifty figure to completely lose his bananas, it does give the idea of the stakes that are happening on the island right now.
And switch gears a little bit here.
Yep.
But while we're talking about Richard trying to get Jack to blow him up, this is not my original thought. I saw this in that blog comment, I think, at some point today. But, you know, harkens back to Michael being unable to kill himself.
Sure.
Is there an actual connection here? Or, you know, is that going to play out? Or in the Lost canon now, did Michael just never happen? Is that just off the table?
I think he happened. I mean, the other thing, you can look at Jack too at the end of end of season three, trying to kill himself, and there's a car crash. I mean, you could look at that as another example of Jack can't kill himself.
That whole touching thing, and you know, that could have gone in a whole different direction. Oh. Is it a good touch or a bad touch?
Oh, sure, we got Court TV here. Yeah, absolutely, a spin-off show. Show me on the doll where Jacob touched you.
Exactly. That could have gone a whole different way, but you know, does it convey different things to different people based on their life situation? I mean, clearly it's just, you know, it's a show on a big network with a regular cast that gets paid pretty well to be on every episode almost, but so they're not going to probably kill people off. But are we to now believe that retroactively that none of them could have died? Because, you know, I mean, Sawyer got touched by Jacob with the pen when he was like, I don't know, a
eight.
Kid.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what that exactly means. It's more mystical.
And I think we'll get that. I mean,
I wasn't clear about, because the way that Alpert phrases it, right, is that when Jacob touches you, he gives you a gift. I don't know if that gift is the same for every person he touches or not. You know, we may just be assuming that.
Right, that's very true.
And I think kind of what I want to get into after the break is that Jacob is good at getting people where they need to be, but he can't make them be the people they're supposed to be when they get there.
And so Jacob's basically, you know, trying to be Mr. Prime Directive from Star Trek? Is that what we're saying?
He's like mystical MapQuest. How about that? He'll get you the directions where you have to go, but we will touch base on more on that after this break. Jack saying, now talk. I did a fist pump. I will not lie. That was one of my favorite moments in Jack history. Because it was, again, an audience moment. Like, yes, tell us answers.
Self-destructive Jack here.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I mean, I think...
Light that fuse. I will take the poison pill.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm liking Jack better than I have for some time on the show.
Jeff Jensen made a good point over on his recap today. So he can't tell if Jack is saner than before or absolutely crazier than before.
He's certainly acting much more the man of faith now, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, he saw whatever he saw when he looked out on the ocean after smashing the lighthouse. It gave him some sort of invulnerability. And we talked before about if Jacob touches you and you can't die, it's one thing to have him touch you and you can't die, but you don't know it. Jack right now thinks he's walking around completely invincible. That there is some at some which might give him the impetus to kind of get off his butt and be less Hamlet, if you will.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like, if I have a choice between self-doubt, angst, emo Jack, and I got crazy eyes Jack, you know, I think I'm taking crazy eyes Jack, most definitely. It's just more entertaining than, you know,
it's true.
The guy who feels sorry for himself.
The last time we saw crazy eye Jack, though, he wanted to leave the island. That's my biggest worry. So it's... Yeah, season four, Jack, was the season of the crazy eyes. And right now, Richard's got the terrified eyes. Now, I thought they were going to go here. When Jack closes his eyes and reopens them, I thought for sure they were going to do a callback to the really close-up of the eyes opening that was a hallmark of season one. That he would close his eyes and be one person and wake up or open them again and be another. They didn't go that route, but The effect may or may not be the same. Oh, those, that that's that creepy, creepy, creepy smile that Jack has. I love.
I thought they were going to go in a direction where Alpert would put out the fuse or somehow, diffuse it himself and decide to. That if Jack had that much faith, that he would just kind of become Jack's new acolyte. But
it's. I mean, it's true. I mean, if you look at the episode, you've got the last three others, if you will, and Alana doesn't really count. But you've got Richard. You've got Alana, and you've got Ben, all three of whom are having their faith in their lives tested mm-hmm. in this episode. Ben, especially right now, with the sound of the smoke monster, which apparently no one else can hear but him, which might be a Turbine Tim moment of the episode. but it gives us a Ben lock scene, so really, am I going to complain? Not really.
No.
And I like the idea, too, that, you know, in terms of being touched and what how it affects what Smock can or cannot do. It doesn't seem like he's allowed to touch somebody who's been touched by
don't
Jacob.
Don't tell him what he can't do.
But it's fun. So much fun. I get the impression if he could kill Alana, he would. But it's against the rules. Is that what, the impression that you guys got?
Yeah, again, with those rules that I would actually like to understand and not have cryptically referred to, and maybe we get the list of rules and like the penultimate episode of the entire series.
They're on the cave wall.
There's going to be a lot of people that he can kill.
Yeah.
It's very true, including the pilot, the original pilot, which calls into question if Frank's a lot more important than we would have ever thought. Because we never got the explanation for why the Freighter 4 were the Freighter 4. Charlotte and Daniel, I guess you can argue, well, they were on the island already, so they had to preserve the space-time continuum or something. But Miles and Frank really are going to, you know, their explanation hopefully will come in this season. But the rules, yeah, I guess, Mo, you'd like to have, like, the sort of the YMCA pool rules, that giant billboard.
Yeah, just post them on the wall so we all know. And that's the thing, it's
Miles was from the island.
My bad. You're absolutely right.
But I'm not clear on Frank's relation in this. He's like somebody who just, he's like the walk-on.
He's the Jeff Bridges of the island. He's the dude.
He's the dude, and I want more of that. Because he's got a great presence, and whenever he's had any substantial scenes, which hasn't been often, he's been great.
Yeah.
And now we've got, I think, one of the crucial episodes, if not the crucial episode, along with the principal confrontation of the entire scene. They're kind of intercut a little bit here. We've got Ben going in to see Principal Reynolds, and he's going to he thinks he's gonna get one over on him.
That's true. And I love that sort of cut there between Ben running in the jungle and sideways Ben arriving at the principal's door there. It was a very nice, it was almost like 2001 throwing a bone up in the air and it turns into a spaceship.
Yes.
And in both cases, we're going to see Ben choose not to do something that he's done in the past. He's not going to sacrifice Alex to achieve his ambitions, and he's not going to get the drop on somebody, and put a bullet in them.
Right. And it's, it did flash through my mind something that people brought up in the comments on my blog of why didn't he just say, okay, as part of my deal to keep quiet about this affair, you have to give Alex a glowing recommendation. But, perhaps this guy has a lot of ties with Yale and could have really just basically, put the kibosh on Alex's application and, put the word out amongst other, someone like this might have a lot of contacts that could really screw up Alex's future. And Ben just decides, quite rightly, he can't take that risk, that there's even a 10% chance that this Reynolds can screw up things for Alex. And I think, It's a great moment because you really don't know what he's going to do. Ben going to be Ben? And there's that line earlier in the episode. He's going to find out he was right about you. I think I have that wrong, but Miles says that to him, that Ben.
Yeah.
Right up until the moment you put the dagger in him, he thought
he was hoping he was wrong about you.
He was hoping he was wrong about you, and I think are we finding out that maybe Jacob was right or Jacob was wrong?
But there's an interesting point here, too. I mean, and I guess arguing the mechanics of the bribe here kind of misses the point. Ben gets to a point, and seeing Alex's name on the screen, realizes the type of person that choice would make him. Mm-hmm. Above and beyond what it would do to Alex, he is at the precipice where he could have been in the van with his father in the other timeline. there is that point of no return, and there's that great shot in the man behind the curtain where he takes off his gas mask, and his eyes are bug-eyed, terrified for a few seconds, and then he takes a breath, and then sort of the Ben lines that we know washes over his face, and he's done from there on in. That walking up and making that choice, and this is why the whole free will thing is so great. The idea that these people seemingly have no choice, and you brought up Michael before, James. Something I want to bring up about Michael's past is that when he talks to Ben on the Kahana, Ben says, "I don't kill innocent people in a war." Michael says, "Anna Lucia and Libby are innocent." And Ben said, "I never told you to kill them." What seemed like something that Michael had to do was, in fact, an act of free will. He chose to do it. And that's the sort of dichotomy you have to look at when you're looking at the man in black versus Jacob in terms of what Jacob's quote-unquote, you know, influence over people truly is.
And I think that what struck home for me about this so much is kind of, you know, getting back to what you said about he killed his own father. You know, he participated in the genocide of the Dharma Initiative. I mean, he's done essentially unforgivable things, and yet... So you would think, well, maybe he's just locked into that. That's all he can do. That's all he can be, is be the bad guy. But yet, after all that, he can still make the choice to try to do something good or something not bad, you know? And I think that's so important to me, just as a human being, like that theme or that idea is really, it just matters to me on an emotional level. Like Ryan was saying, when Lost lands that kind of hard-fought lesson about human nature and gets you to that point where you're actually thinking about life choices and you know, this kind of very poignant morality tale. I just love that. And I think that's really when it carries the most weight for me. And then it's so much more than just something I love to geek out about, which I love, but this is something about humanity that I think is really moving and touching.
And by the way, we're saying all this while we're watching this fantastic scene of Ben spilling his guts to Alana in the middle of the jungle.
Yep.
You know, and the funny thing is, Alana for me is entirely not a character in the show. She's sort of a weak link. We know nothing about her. She's kind of a plot device. In a way, that almost strengthens this scene for me. Like, Ben just has no one that he can tell this to. He might as well be talking to, you know, I mean, Alana, I think I was telling you earlier, Mo, she's like a rifle with legs.
Right.
he could, you know, he could just soon be telling this to a tree, but who else can, you know, he just needs to say this.
And it's interesting that this all happens in the same week that Chuck finally gets to get some stuff off his chest.
Right. It's a week of confessions.
I mean, a question for you guys, by the way, while we're talking about Blizzard Ben's redemption. I've thought for a while he's got to be moving toward, like, his arc. Ben doesn't come out of this alive. It seems to me everything that I know about stories and that I've seen in other, you know, fictions says Ben is moving towards some sort of Sidney Carton, you know, doing one last great redemptive thing, this kind of, you know...
He's the guy that goes...
Anakin Skywalker, you know, kills the Emperor, pulls his mask off, and dies redeemed.
Right.
Yep.
He's the guy that goes into the belly of the ship in Razor, and he's like the Jack, you know, the kind of like the jerk guy in Battlestar Galactica Razor. There's always that guy. There's always that trope where it's like, no, but I'll save the ship and I'll give my life. It'll be my last good thing that
I do. It is a far, far better thing than I've done before. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's cool because we love that arc because it speaks to me certainly in that people can be redeemed no matter, you know, how awful they've been.
Absolutely. And we'll discuss Ben's final, you know, bend towards that arc after the break. Now, dramatically speaking, this is the moment where I may have, you know, stood up and screamed as aforementioned. I was completely expecting the show to give Ben a Saeed moment where he comes up to the point where he should change and falls into old habits, especially when he grabs the nameplate here.
That's beautiful.
But clearly they're using audience expectations against them, which is the entire point of the Sideways in some way, shape, or form, is to take what the audience knows and use that and abuse them with it to misdirect them.
Well, but I think, James, you were making a really interesting point today about, and maybe you did too, Ryan, about the idea that Saeed didn't really change. The whole point, I mean, I was okay with that episode.
No, he didn't. Absolutely no.
It was essentially rebooting Saeed in a different universe, but really he's got the same set of problems, and he can't really escape from this tortured killer identity that he's got.
The way I rationalized that, because, yeah, I developed this theory that I loved about how all the Flash sideways are about people, you know, in these situations where they've made the same mistakes over and over again and we're tired of seeing that and finally breaking the pattern. And I thought, oh, well, Saeed still had to kill a dude. He still had to be the badass and he couldn't escape that pit. But, you know, when you think about it, that ended on him, in that Quentin Tarantino situation, finding a gin in the back room, and that also you could pretty much slap it to be continued on that.
I hear that.
You know how that goes forward, but it seems like his Flash sideways story is not done. I'm guessing. So that's my story.
Okay. Whatever floats your boat. And there's Arts again. I mean, I think, you know, I would take Ryan's point that probably for me, I think I'm done with Arts, and I think, you know, at some point we would get to that point where, you know, people would start arguing about, like, why aren't they doing this? Which is, you know, during last year's Battlestar Galactica final set of episodes, I kept telling people, you know, stop obsessing about your laundry list of what they're not doing. But I think as a fan of a show, we all get to that stage where we just think, boy, you know, they really, I kind of don't know that I care as much about this. How about this other giant pile of stuff they could be doing? Like, hello, Desmond. Anybody, you know?
And it's true. And we got Ben walking out of the jungle. And what I saw in Ben here was this was the boy that got shot by Saeed that was somehow opening his eyes for the first time since being taken to the temple. The idea that, you know, what you need is some sort of basic form of community in order to, and it's funny because Ben had been surrounded by people for most of his life, but he kept them at arm's length. He kept them in fear. He kept them in deception, constantly in the dark, playing against each other so none of them could take over. So he was surrounded by people, but completely alone. And now he's part of this sort of makeshift community, which, by the way, is horribly outmatched against Team Smock right now. I mean, if you had to have a game of Red Rover right now, even that... These guys are getting their butts kicked.
Well, yeah. I don't know that Team Smock is all that unified. I mean, Kate sort of walked off with those folks and did not look at all pleased to be at that particular shindig. And, oh, now we've got... Sorry, I'm segueing a little bit into what's actually happening on the screen. We're getting a montage of
it's going to be Miles a montage.
And then Ryan, kick this off for us. It's the romantic...
Super slow-mo montage! We've seen it in season 2. We've seen it, I think, twice in season 3. It's an oldie but goodie. I mean, I remember the first time we had one of these, Rose and Bernard met for the first time. And it got dusty in the room, I'll say that much.
This was not so much dusty as, really, this again? For me, anyway. Maybe I just don't have a heart. James, are you actually human? Do you have a soul? Did this move you at all?
The problem is, I think this goes more to the mechanics of the show for me, is that at this point in the series, I kind of have to sit myself down at this point and think, okay, Sun last saw Hurley, it was with, and it was this year, and, you know, it's like, when it gets to the point, you know, Rose and Bernard getting together, that's simple, it's moving. Here, when I kind of got to take out my three-dimensional map and timeline,
of course,
that undermines that a little bit.
Come on, so doesn't someone want to give Ben a hug?
Oh, give him a hug.
And now here we go. Here's my Turban Tim moment of the episode. And I think that mechanics behind it are cool, but I just saw Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus when that...
And I wanted it to be that.
How cool would it be if Debbie Gibson came to the island and Lorenzo Lamas? That would be fantastic. And obviously this is a cliffhanger going into next week. And I think the homework assignment for everyone is to go back and watch The Life and Death of Jeremy Bentham. To get a sense of, you know, the war that Widmore prophesied in that episode is coming to pass. Now, whether or not he sent Locke in order to kickstart the war off, or if he has been as deceived as everyone else and is coming there to sort of make amends, that will inform the rest of the season, I suppose. It did feel weird to have the submarine, and clearly it's the same submarine they've used before. I mean, that was the Galaga, and not in the Galaga on the show, but it's the same submarine that they just have kind of kicking around. But hey, you know, Lost has a budget. I understand. It's fine. They can't build a brand new sub just for Widmore. They don't have as much money as he does.
Yeah, submarines.
Exactly.
I gotta say, though, if you're going to choose your ocean-going craft, the Black Rock is looking better to me, personally. I mean, that thing looks like it's going to last for 10,000 more years.
I mean, and we still haven't really talked about...
like the budget model.
Especially considering the fact that we still don't know how the heck it ended up a mile and a half inland. Because we saw it offshore. I thought that maybe, like, you know, the island landed on it during one of its flashes. And all of a sudden, they're like,
maybe we'll see the tsunami in some future episode.
Exactly. Well, we're going to get
that hit the ship, 30 seconds after Jacob and the Man in Black were looking at it.
Exactly. Who knows? I mean, we're going to get the Richard episode sooner rather than later. So we're going to... And hopefully that won't be maybe it'll be a flash sideways. I prefer a return to the flashback. We need at some point that has to come back into play. Otherwise, it's just a ton of exposition, which will be deadly to watch. But
the Lost guys always say that's deadly to watch. At some point, though, I know shows have to do it.
Yep.
So sometimes I'd rather just have an exposition dump than a lot of convoluted stuff that could have just been explained in a character's exchanging, 8 sentences.
So Dogen's pre-death download was cool with you?
Oh, totally. Because, he's a good actor, and, you could give Michael Emerson exposition for days, and I wouldn't care.
Sure.
You give Kate exposition, I'm going to get bored. I mean, it's just, it depends. I'm sorry, I'm fickle that way.
No, it's true. It is fickle that way. I mean, obviously, we're telling, us telling the writers what they should do with a Richard episode. Silly. Clearly, they have a better idea about what they how they want to impart that information.
I want to see Richard Alpert as a seagoing pirate with possibly an eye patch. And I don't think that's asking too much.
But if he covers up his eye, how are you going to see the eyeliner?
Well, he'll have the other eye. And maybe maybe the parrot on his shoulder will also have eyeliner.
So you're not going for sexy galley slave in chains?
Ooh. Yeah, I'm going to change my vote on that.
Uh-oh. This podcast is going into a dark, dark, weird place near the end of the episode.
We already had the butt shots. There's really nowhere to go but down.
See, it's one thing to have fanfic, but once it goes to slashfic, I don't know.
I think slavefic is that's where we're going with Richard Alpert.
So we're going to have him in the Princess Leia gear because these guys are huge Star Wars fans?
Why aren't you writing this show?
There are so many reasons.
I want to see Ryan.
I'm the guy who thought that Cloverfield was a Lost movie before it came out, so... I was convinced that's why Jack was so depressed and through the looking glass, because he had inadvertently left Smokey off the island, and it was causing havoc in New York, and so he had to go back. But yeah, this is why I write about the show and why I don't actually write the show.
Now I'm going to be permanently disappointed by whatever happens with Richard Alpert.
You know what? There's this little thing called Photoshop, Mo. I'm sure you can...
I'm going to look into that.
Do it to your heart's content, and please, for the love of God, just never share it with anyone.
No, of course.
In the meantime, you'll just have to settle for your stills of Nestor Carbonell as Bat-Manuel from the Tick.
Oh.
And believe me, those are plenty fine.
Oh, it's fine.
Can never get enough of that.
And I want to thank James for hopping on our podcast this week. You were a great addition, a lot of great insight, and it was nice to finally get to talk to you.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Mo, any last thoughts?
We will invite you back, and we'll see if you're actually lying about that. But we had a lot of fun, and hope you did too.
And thank you to all the listeners at home for listening to another edition of Orientation Ryan Station. We'll be back next week with another podcast and another mystery guest. Take care, everybody.
Okay.
All right, thanks.